Hello everyone, welcome back. This is our third podcast. I've been frantically writing down a few memories since the last ones. Let's start off with working in Television Centre, part of the videotape current operations, which means we used to get tapes out for recording sessions, edits, transmissions, and the next day's work in advance sort of thing too. Part of the department was called tape servicing, which we did on a rota. I can't remember, it must have been about once every 10 or 12 weeks, and we'd be a whole week in this one department working. Excuse me. And it was people who are into archive television will now be cringing when I say, when I tell you what we used to do. We used to have lists of videotape that was no longer required. We used to get lists back down from the department heads at Television Centre, you know, drama, light entertainment, any, you know, department, music, whatever. And we'd send them a massive list. Sometimes it would be 3 or 4 inches thick, this printout from the computer. Can you imagine how much information was on those lists? But the main thing was for them to literally physically go through it with a pen and mark next to all the tapes, please keep or wipe. Now, if we had an edited program, some sort of drama, and we had a transmission copy, then everything else could be wiped. Film inserts that have been telecined onto tape, studio recordings, everything that went into making up a program. But once it was edited together into a TX copy, and it had been transmitted as well, and then maybe people like BBC Enterprises would have a copy, a dub of the master, the transmission master, for them to sell abroad, then all the other ingredients that went into making up the program were liable for wiping because we didn't need them anymore and they were taking up space. And if you reused and wiped the tape, we could save money. Now, 90 minute tapes are quite expensive when you're buying by the thousand. Excuse me. So we used to have a department out by dispatch in the Television Centre Spur, which was called tape servicing. And you used to walk in and you would have, I think it was 3 1-inch machines, and believe it or not, even when I was there in the mid-80s, a 2-inch videotape machine. Now, 2-inch videotape came in the late 50s from America, but obviously by the late 70s, no, a little bit later than that, early 80s, it would change to 1-inch wide videotape. So 2-inch was virtually finished with. But of course, we had so many programs that was still on 2-inch tape. We had to keep some machines in working order for transmission for a start. And we had to have a special wiping machine for 2-inch tapes, because obviously 2-inch is different from 1-inch. So you'd walk into the office and there would be 3 1-inch machines, wiping machines, and a 2-inch. Now, what all these machines would do, you would lace up the, because they were open reel tapes, that you would lace up the machine, fast forward it to the end, and then the machine would automatically rewind the whole reel. Now, if it was a 90-minute spool, that would actually take quite a while. That would take a good sort of 15, 20 minutes even for 90 minutes of tape to work its way through. But as it, on the rewind, what the thing used to do, it would analyze the tape as it ran through the head, we'll call it the head, like a recording head, and it would actually analyze the tape in 3 different places at the same time. It would be in the middle, right in the middle of the tape, and on the 2 edges. Now, if there was physical, and what happened was, it would rewind back to the start and then stop. And then it would give you a little paper printout. and it would that printout would then tell you how many defects were on that tape, in the middle, on one edge, and on the other edge. Now, if it exceeded a certain number in total, and I can't remember how many that was, then that tape was no good for reuse. Sometimes it would have been used, that tape would have been used in, say, a recording session or a dubbing session, and it would be stopping and starting on the machines all day. Now, that is not good for a tape, so that would sometimes that would make the defects on the tape. But sometimes it would just be a bad tape that's been used once, and on our machines it would come back and go, this is no good. Even though it's only been recorded on once, it's still no good for us to reuse, because you can't have a studio recording of a massively expensive variety program being rendered no good because the tape you put in the machine to record it on is duff. So you had to weedle out the bad tapes compared to the good ones. And now what happened was, we used to have another machine at the back of the room where if you had a bad tape, and now don't forget, we were also running through not just 90 minute tapes, but you go through 60 minute tapes and 30 minute tapes. Now, when you were making a program, and let's you say you had a telecine session for recording some pieces that were filmed, that were shot on film, but were needed in the edit on VT, then they would be telecined onto a tape. Now, if you had only 9 minutes of film rushes, there is no point in using a 90-minute blank tape, because it costs more to the production and it's just a waste of tape. So you'd use a 30 for 9 minutes of recording, obviously. So we were running through 90s, 60s and 30s all day long, and plus whatever 2-inch tapes were coming through the system too. On the Monday morning when you walked into that office, you'd be confronted by at least 2 trolley loads of tapes in piles on it. And you'd look at it and go, oh God, look at all that tape. And that would be your week's work, because you had to write down on a sheet, on a form, which tapes you'd wiped, what their tape, what their original tape numbers were, and how long they were, and whether you kept them or wiped them. And then that was handed in at the end of the week, so people could keep track of how many tapes we were reusing and throwing away. So, as I say, if a tape came off a machine and it was no good, so what are you going to do with it? So you can't just, well, you couldn't just put it in the bin, because it's a massive metal reel and there's all that tape on it, and you've got the box that it's in, a thick plastic box. What are you going to do with all this stuff? You can't just put it in a skip. Well, you could, but we had this machine where you put the open reel into it and you had to close the door, which was like a cage, and the machine wouldn't work until you closed the door and locked and clicked it shut. Because then you pressed a button in the to the on position, and you would have a massive under pressure blade that went down the middle of the spool and cut the tape right down to the very middle of the spool, and then come back up again electronically. It would sense when it got to the middle of the reel and then come back up, and it would splice the tape into 10 inch lengths. The whole tape, and it would take about a minute. So the pressure in that machine was unbelievable, and you didn't want to get your hand in there because it probably cut it off. So that's why it only worked when you clicked it shut and locked it, sort of thing, before you pressed. If you pressed the button with the door open, it wouldn't work, which is quite a good safety thing, really. So, and then, of course, at the end of the day, you had a massive bin full of videotape that is now only in 10-inch lengths, which is no good for anything. So that would be scrapped. Literally, physically. And we used to, I don't know what we used to do with the empty spools and the empty boxes. We must have reused them somehow, because I don't remember them going in the bin. So anyway, for all you people that are into archive television and keep going on about, oh, the BBC never saved anything, it threw everything away. It was a different culture back then. It was nothing like we've got to keep everything, because and it's a hackneyed expression, but we didn't have the money and we didn't have the space, because the money was being used, in theory, to make programs. And the amount of space that was needed was unbelievable. I mean, I used to go down to the film and videotape library in Wimmore Road in Brentford in West London now and again. And that place, I don't know when they opened that. It might have been the 50s. It might have been the only place they ever used. They moved, obviously, a little while ago now. But that place was literally warehouses full of videotapes and film and magnetic reels, and it was unbelievable. And you walk down a column of tapes on shelves, and you'd look at them, and you look at one, it'd say Doctor Who, and then six tapes along, because they were in numerical order, six tapes along would be that year's FA Cup final, first half. It could be anything. You know, it could be a feature film on three reels of videotape. You know, the stuff that was in there was unbelievable. And we had an online computer system called VTOL, which is now gone. That stood for Videotape Online. And that was part of my first job at Television Centre, to catalogue and input the new recordings and new tapes onto the system, so that people could then, you know, around that was linked to all the regions, Manchester, Glasgow, Belfast, you know, Cardiff, Leeds, you name it. And people could log onto that computer system and then type in their search for whatever they were looking for. And then it would come up with what tapes were associated with that program number and that episode of whatever program they wanted. And that's the way they used to get hold of the tape numbers. And then when they came to editing, for whatever reason, they would then supply us in VT Current Ops with a list for the next day's edit and where the edit, which machine, and where the edit was going to be. And our job was during the day before was to get all those tapes together, because they could be spread around the BBC. Some would be in a region, you know, someone would say, oh, we need this tape for 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And you look it up on the computer and it'd be in Glasgow. So you'd have to ring the Glasgow library and say, send this down overnight, because we need it for tomorrow afternoon. Sometimes they say, well, we need it, and you'd have to get back onto production and say, can't get it tomorrow, so we have to find an alternative, or they'd have to wait for it. So that was part of our duties in Current Ops. And then on the morning, you'd have to take the tapes round to the different machines and places for the edits and the transmissions, and yeah, that was it. So you certainly got fit, because some of the places were quite a long way away from the office. And if someone rung up and said, oh, I need these four tapes now in VT36. And it turns out that they're four 90-minute, 2-inch tapes, and you had to walk them round, which would take you 10 minutes to walk. By the time you got back to the office, your arms were about an inch longer than when you left, because those things were heavy. So it's like, oh, they're not 2-inch, are they? Yeah. And you could tell if they were 2-inch, because they were just a six figure number, sort of 696321. And you knew straight away, because it didn't have a prefix before it, like a letter, that it was 2-inch. And it's like, oh, no, have I got to go and get those? After a while, when we had 1-inch, they were all H numbers. For helical scan on the machines. Sport tapes had a J prefix. I don't know why it was J. But you knew, because the sport tapes were kept in a separate library from everything else, because there were so many. In fact, I remember that leads me onto one thing, one memory I have of, it was a Sunday afternoon or a Sunday morning, and Steve, he was a sports PA, I can't remember his surname now, came in with a list of tapes for an edit for that afternoon. And he gave me a list. It was only about six tapes. And first thing you do is bash them into the computer, find out where they are. Now, if a tape is being used in an edit somewhere, you could actually enter that into the computer on that particular spore number, and you just type in, and it would automatically give you the date, the current date, and you would just book it out to sort of VT10 or VT36, wherever it was, so that when you did a spool inquiry, it would say, oh, it's at Windmill Road, or it's on the shelf because it's a newer tape, or it's in VT27. So you'd have to get them all together from different places. If it was down at the library, you'd have to ring up the library, tell them to get these tapes out, and then they'd put them on a taxi, or if you were lucky, a BBC van, and deliver it back to Television Centre in time for the edit. Now, one of these tapes that Steve gave me was coming up as DNE, does not exist. Now, usually when that happens, the person has given you the wrong tape number. Either it's or they've jumbled the numbers. So let's say J2534 he wants, and he's given you J5234. So you have to become an expert into slightly juggling the numbers before you ring him back and say, is this the right number? Anyway, this thing was not coming up because I said to him, is this the right number? Yeah, it's the right number. He said it's an Olympics tape. Ah, so it's 86, Mexico Olympics. It was a recording. He said, but I want it for this afternoon's Grand Prix edit. That they did a recording on that spool from the new circuit, which was being built during the Olympics. And now it was finished, and they were going to preview that in that evening's Grand Prix program on Sunday evening after the race. And I said, Steve, this doesn't exist. And he said, I said, is it a Grand Prix tape? No, it's an Olympics tape. Okay. And someone said, oh, don't forget, Gary, about 3 weeks ago, we had that sport wiping list in. So, oh, okay. So then I go to this, which we used to keep those. And this list of tapes was 4 inches thick paper. So anyway, I went through that, and it took a while, and I found that tape. And of course, what was next to it? Please wipe. So we knew that it was a recent list, so the tapes might not, fingers crossed, physically have been wiped yet. They might be out for wiping, but not been put through the machine yet. It was a degausser, where what you used to do with that machine for quickness, as opposed to the way we were doing it on the machines that I mentioned earlier, was you put it on a big machine with a conveyor belt on it, and it would just go, just the spool, not in the box. And it would go through this electromagnetic thing in one end of the machine. And it would come out the end of that completely blank. So you got a new tape to use. So I saw it in the list that it said, please wipe. And I knew that the other room where we kept tapes that were up for wiping but hadn't been wiped yet was full of tapes. So, excuse me, the sports PA, Steve, came round and he said, what do you reckon, Gary? I said, mate, it's been wiped. And he's gone, what? I said, well, it was on a bloody Olympics tape, not a motor racing tape. He's gone, oh, my God. I said, but if you want to come round with me, with any luck, the tapes are still on the shelf in the wiping room, not been touched yet. OK, so we walk round there and we go in and we're confronted by 2,000 tapes on shelves. Okay, not too bad, you might think, because we've got the tape number. But the process for wiping had actually been started by the guys in there. And what's the first thing you do is you pull off the tape numbers from the box on the outside. So we were confronted by 2,000 light blue tape boxes, none of them with numbers. So what does that mean? That means we've got to open every one in the hope that we're going to find the one that we want. So I said to Steve, you start over there, I'll start over there, and we'll meet in the middle. And this was going to take a long time. This wasn't going to take 10 minutes. Anyway, after about 20 minutes, I opened up it, and you just got to work along a shelf. You know, if you knew it was, excuse me, you knew, say, it was a 90-minute tape that you were looking for, so you knew you didn't want a tape with a blue or a green label because they were 60 and 30-minute tapes. So you knew there's no point looking in those because the tape wouldn't have fitted into the box. So, okay, you're looking in the big ones, the large boxes. As luck would have it, after about 20 minutes, I opened a box and I said, "Steve, what was the number?" And he told me, and I went, "Is it this one?" And he went, "That's it." And so we checked the recording report, and yep, lo and behold, 35 minutes into the tape, it said, Mexico Grand Prix recording, preview of circuit. And he said, "That's it." So he took it away, and I said to him as we walked out, I said, "Steve, does this mean I get a credit on tonight's programme?" And he went, he just looked, "I'm going to swear now, ladies and gentlemen." He looked at me, he went, "Like, fuck you will." And of course I didn't. Now, but funny enough, the strange thing is, he was a PA for Grand Prix and Grandstand for a while, and then he left. I don't know where he went. But the weird thing was, we now jump to 1997, which is at least 10 years later, and I'm now working for Formula One, and I'm in the, I think it was the first race I ever did, which was Melbourne, Australia, 1997. I was doing slow motion replays and graphics for Formula One for the world feed. And I'm in the paddock, and a guy walks up to me, and I'm wearing a Formula One uniform, and he just walks up to me outside what we used to call the village, and he says, "Excuse me, mate." And he had a tape in his hand, a little beta SP. And I turn around and said, "Yeah." And he's gone, "I know you, don't I?" And I've gone, "Hello, Steve." And he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I work for Formula One." I said, "What are you doing here?" And I can't remember who he's working for. He said, "Oh, Gary, can you do me a favour?" He said, "We've got to get this on the satellite in the next 10 minutes. He said, "We've got it booked." He said, "But I'm not allowed to go in there. Can you help me?" And I said, "Well, yeah, of course. Where's he got to go?" And he told me where. It was just a play-out room. I said, "I'll take it in there." I said, "You hang on here and I'll let you know." So the weird thing was, I walked his tape in there. I said, "Oh, this is for 10 minutes on the satellite back to the UK." "Yeah, okay, mate." And it was some rushes that had been filmed out on the circuit. And I walked back, and Steve was still standing there outside because he didn't have the right pass. And I said, "That's all right, mate, it's done." He said, "I can't believe you're here, Gary." He said, "Thanks for that." He said, "Bloody hell, how long have you been here?" I said, "I've only been here about 2 days." So that was funny, wasn't it? Bumping into someone, or television, you meet everyone all the time, I suppose. That was it. I was going to say, talking about servicing, and especially 2-inch tapes, have a guess. Now, we're talking about 1983 when this stopped. What do you think the last program to be recorded on the out-of-date 2-inch tape was? Answers on a postcard to the above address. I'll tell you now. And it was, now, 2-inch, in theory, actually, was better quality than 1-inch. But, so the last thing that was recorded every week was the PSB, which is a program as broadcast, which means live, Wogan. Wogan's, I think he went Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And those programs were recorded live from the studio. None of it was pre-recorded at all. Excuse me. So that was recorded straight down the line into VT in the basement onto a 2-inch. But after, I think, 83, then even they had to succumb to 1-inch. But that was the last, as far as I know, that was the last recording made on 2-inch videotape. There you go. That was that. And of course, actually, so some of the things, when you were in servicing and you were confronted by these trolley loads of tapes to wipe, they could be anything. They could be sport. It depends on what department had recently received a wiping list. And I think the wiping lists were annual. So can you imagine these departments? They were generating huge amounts of tapes and material over 12 months. And sometimes you'd walk in and there'd be a ton, you know, there'd be 500 sport tapes. And these would be, you know, live recordings of football matches or athletics, swimming, you name it, golf. And if you've got a transmission master, there's no point keeping all these recordings because you'll never need them again. Later, we found out with sort of DVD releases that it would have been really, really handy to have kept some of them, but they weren't. Because we needed the space, mainly, and we needed to reuse tape too. But sometimes you would find that you had a pile of tapes from either light entertainment or the comedy department. Now, which is where it got quite interesting. If maybe like you was into comedy and maybe music specifically, you would have a pile of tapes and you'd look at them and go, well, okay, so there's some, let's say, Blackadder studio recordings. Now, obviously, the thing's been transmitted already, it's been edited, it's been dubbed for enterprises, so the actual original studio recordings are not needed at all now, because I probably in those days they were just starting, weren't they, VHS releases. And that was it. So sometimes, if it was a programme I liked, I would ring a couple of mates up in VT and say, I've got a tape here, any chance of a VHS dub before I wipe it? And they go, yeah, bring it up. Leave it with me. And so by the end of the day, the tape would be returned and you'd have a VHS copy of it. Now, obviously, then the 1-inch was then at some point in the next few days wiped, because that's what we had to do. But that VHS, which is now the only remaining copy of, let's say, a Blackadder studio recording, a couple of which I did keep, is now the only copy. And I diligently kept those for years. And I've now given them back to the Beeb. And some of them have been used in things like Blackadder, the latest, a couple of years ago, Blackadder Blu-ray box set. One of the things, funny enough, separately we used to get in Current Ops was every so often a department would come down and two of the girls or one of the guys from the office would, from the production office, would bring down a massive box of VHSs of their programs that had been dubbed onto VHS a year before. And now, you know, and that's just like a viewing copy in the office to look at and maybe do an offline edit or just have a look at stuff. Sometimes it would have burnt in time codes, sometimes it wouldn't. And we would suddenly have a massive box of bloody VHSs to throw in the bin. Now, what we used to do, quite frankly, was if it was a 3-hour tape and there's only a 50-minute recording on it, we'd take them home and record what we wanted off air at home, you know, whatever films you wanted to see, whatever. But, of course, if it was something like a studio recording of a comedy, then it's like, well, I'll have that and just keep it and not wipe it, because it was something that you'd like to see. And if you were doing due diligence, you'd check the computer and find that the tape that it was copied from now doesn't exist. So that VHS that you've got there is now, again, the only copy. I remember one time, and I kept this tape for years. It was a 30-minute VHS, so not really much good for recording stuff on. And it said Blackadder on it, but it had a really funny program number. And I thought, what's that? So I looked up the program number on the VTOL computer system, and it was the Blackadder pilot, the untransmitted pilot, which had never been out. It never went out ever. I don't know if it's been out now. I think it became something like the script was reused for episode 3 or episode 4 in series 1 of Blackadder. But it had a completely different cast apart from Rowan Atkinson. No one else was carried forward from the pilot. And it wasn't very good. But, you know, an oddity to see. I think they might have put that on that latest Blu-ray set. You can message me to tell me if it is or not. But I had the VHS, and I've now found out that later, apparently, I think the edited master tape, even though it was untransmitted, was kept. But at some point, it was damaged, physically damaged, maybe running through a machine. And my VHS was recorded off the tape before it was damaged. So I think that was maybe a better quality copy than what exists now, which is a shame. But, yeah, so you'd get things like that. So you'd always go through the VHS boxes and just see what was on the tapes before you took a moment and recorded tomorrow night's James Bond film off ITV, that sort of thing. So, yeah. Can you imagine the amount of stuff that went through that office? One of the other things I kept, funnily enough, on VHS was a comic relief recording in 89, quite late for me because that was when I left, was a comic relief recording, and it was the New Statesman, Rick Mayall. Obviously, that was an ITV programme, but he obviously did a special recording at the Beeb for comic relief. And I found the and kept the studio recording, funnily enough. So that was that. Yes, I had my first, because I could just about afford it, my very first home video machine was actually a Philips 7, I think it was a 1702 machine. I think the first Philips home domestic VHS was a 1500 and a 1505. This was slightly newer and cost me an absolute bloody fortune in 1979. Anyway, in fact, one of the things I recorded very early on and always kept was the very first transmission of Fawlty Towers the Rat. Now, those videotapes were really expensive. They were like 40 quid for a 120 in those days. My goodness, the amount of money I must have spent. But I recorded one evening, and Beatles fans will know this date, the 9th of December 1980, which was the day that Lennon was shot. And that evening's Nationwide was dedicated to John. And I actually recorded, I don't know why I recorded it now, perhaps I just wanted to, I don't know. But I recorded the whole thing from about 2 minutes, to, it was on air at 6. So I started the recording about 2 minutes before, and it was a 60. And I let it run all the way to the end, because I know they played Help straight after Nationwide finished. So I recorded the whole program without stopping. In fact, I can't remember watching it back afterwards. A little bit too harrowing for that sort of thing. And I kept the tape. And years later, gosh, it must have been 1990s, maybe the mid-90s, when my former boss in cataloguing at Terrington Centre, the much-missed Christine Slattery, was now head of the film and videotape library at Brentford, Windmill Road. And I used to go maybe once a month. We'd have lunch round the corner in the Globe pub. And we'd just have a chat, you know, about what's happening. I by this time, had now left the Beeb. So she was interested in what I was doing outside. And she was now head of the library. And I said to her one day, I said, Christine, listen, just wondering. And I think it was when I was on the phone to her. I'm going through my old tapes in a cupboard here. And I said, I've got some of my old Philips cassettes. I said, listen, have you got Nationwide from the 9th of December 1980? She said, I don't know. Why? I said, well, I've got my off-air copy here. So she said, hang on a minute. So I heard her, you can hear her tapping away on the keyboard. She came up and said, no, that was never recorded, Gary. It was never recorded. It was not an ROT, which is recorded off transmission. And I said, oh, do you want it? She said, well, why? I said, well, that was the night Lennon was shot. She's gone, oh, okay. Yeah, we'll have that. So the next time I met her for lunch, I took it with me and gave it to her. And apparently they had to send it up to, was it the Museum of the Moving Image in Manchester? Because they had a working Philips machine and it was dubbed onto, I don't know what it was dubbed onto, probably Digibeta. And that's now in the BBC archive, Nationwide of the 9th of December. And it's I think it's labelled as domestic recording. Well, guess what? That was mine. So, not that you want to see it. But, yeah, that was one of the things I gave back amongst quite a few other bits and pieces. Jumping back to, got only a few more things. Sorry, it won't be long now, people. I won't be boring you much longer. Going back to, if you remember, I was talking in the last episode about radio recordings, principally at the Paris Theatre in Lower Regent Street for, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue with the original gang of six. I remember that. I only remember this the other day. There was hardly any retakes. Certainly no retakes of actual rounds. There might have been very, very odd where they'd redo a whole round and try to make it better. But the main, if there was any take, any retakes, what they would have been some of Hump's announcements, intros leading into the next round and that sort of stuff, if he fluffed it, or sometimes he'd do it straight away afterwards during the recording, but sometimes they'd say at the end, Humph, we just need to do, you know, intro into round four again, please. And he'd redo it. And of course, he'd get almighty amounts of stick from the rest of the boys for cocking it up and stopping them from going home. yeah, that was all part of the fun. I must tell you about a lady that our family knew. She was working at the BBC when I was still at school, and I professed an interest in working for the Beeb, not really knowing what I wanted to do. After a while, I did. She was in, I think Dee was in transport, which is obviously not production, but goodness me, what a busy department that must have been. Can you imagine ordering vehicles and trucks for outside broadcasts, for filming sessions, and even just for taxis to take people home? Can you imagine the amount of taxis we used? Anyway, she got me in when I was still at school. And I reckon this is about 1975. While I was still at school, she got me in because Dee knew everyone, you know, from producers all the way down to makeup girls and tea ladies. You know, because she'd been there. So, in fact, I think that was the only place she worked. And she managed to get me during the summer holidays, school summer holidays. Gary, would you like to come round Television Centre? And it's like, would I? So anyway, I went up there, met her, and she took me round the studios. Now, like anyone at the age of 15, it's like, whoa, this is Mecca. This is, you know, this is it. This is the place. And I remember she got us into... Now, which was the big studio at Television Centre? Was it three? I think it was. It was the big, or six, one of the two. And it was, believe it or not, that was set up for the Duchess of Duke Street. Do you remember that? And it was a massive set. They must have had four different sets within the studio that they were using, you know, at the same time. I don't know whether they must have been there for a week because it was such a big set. And that was unbelievable because you'd seen it on the telly and suddenly you're walking into the living room of whatever the place was and you're standing there. And of course, in those days, you couldn't take pictures. I didn't take a camera. Of course, you didn't have camera phones, which would have been so handy. But, and I think someone took us round. It might have been the studio, the floor manager for that. Anyway, but then she also took us straight up to the control room. And it was a little bit intimidating because you've got about seven or eight people in there, including the director. And you've got all these TV screens and, buttons and desks. And I didn't know what any of it did at all at that point. But my God, the stuff, it was just heaven. And anyway, she introduced me to, I want to say, the director, and I think it was Gareth Gwendolyn, who did a ton of comedy stuff. But why he was involved, I have looked him up. I don't know why he was involved with the Duchess of Duke Street. Anyway, he was very nice. He must have sat there for 10 minutes talking to this little kid who was like, oh, can I work for the BBC? And then I think she took us to lunch, or took me to lunch. So can you imagine? And of course, if you're sitting in the canteen, you're seeing people from the programmes, you know, which was unbelievable. So you're sitting on a table and two tables over is someone from, you know, Grandstand or, you know, whatever programmes are being produced that week, you know. Patrick Moore from The Sky at Night would be over in the corner, you know, unbelievable. Anyway, so that was probably, yes, it was my first taste of being in a television studio, and it was unbelievable. Anyway, Dee's family, her daughter was a makeup girl, and she was married to Joe,
who was a lighting supervisor at Ealing, BBC Ealing, which is different from Television Centre because Ealing was film, not videotape. Ealing was never videotape, it was film. So after a while, I was quite good with a stills camera, and I'd bought myself and was making my own films on Super 8 as well. So I thought, I want to be a film cameraman. So we talked to Joe, who worked at Ealing. You know, only. He didn't work anywhere. Well, he did later on, but he was primarily a film lighting supervisor. So Joe, I remember one Sunday, they were coming over to visit us, the family, and Joe said, he got there, he said, listen, Gary, I'm going to Ealing. I'm picking up my per diems. He'd been on a trip and he had some money outstanding. So he's going to go and just collect the cash Sunday morning. Do you want to come? And it's like, do I? So we drove over to Ealing, the film studios. And of course, there's no one about Sundays. So we go in and we get his money in an envelope. And he said, come on in, I'll show you around. So he took me through to the stages. I can't remember how many stages were at Ealing now. But we went in certainly two. And one of them, this will date it. I'll have to look up when this program was produced. It was the courtyard set for Colditz. And you open the set, went through the dark bit where the drapes are. And you were then standing in the courtyard of Colditz Castle that you've seen on the television. I used to watch Colditz. It was a really good drama. David McCallum, Jack Headley, I remember. Brilliant. And you're suddenly standing in the bloody courtyard with all the, gosh, the cobbled stones, which are plastic. And it's like, whoa. So anyway, so then we go to the next one. Now, coming on to comedy, the other set, the other stage we went in was a set for the goodies. Now, if you can, if any of you listening can tell me which episode this is, I'd love to find out which one it was. And it was a model set of a train running through like a rocky landscape or a viaduct or something. And I have a feeling, which episode was it where a duck or a goose was dropping eggs on them while the train is moving along? I have a feeling it was that set. Now, which episode was that? Someone will be able to tell me. Anyway, so that was it. So that was like, whoa. And this thing was not small. This thing was maybe 25 feet long. It was a big old set. Amazing, you know, to see that. So once again, I'm hooked on working in television, aren't I? So I decided over then that I'd like to be a film cameraman. But of course, in those days, there was no, there was only three TV channels, BBC One and Two and ITV, not even Channel Four or Channel Five. And I started work through this lady, D. She saw the advert for me for the transcription service, which is, she said, well, you like records, as I said in the previous podcast. So I got in, I thought, well, at least I'm inside the BBC. It's not working for television, but at least I'm in the BBC for a start. So during my time at transcriptions, I must have applied for attachments for assistant film cameraman, you name it, at Ealing. And I didn't get one of them because I think at the time, actual film cameramen in the department, there might have been only 20. So if so, now the only time people left from being a cameraman at Ealing was either they retired or they went to ITV to get double the money. And that was it. So you were maybe lucky to get one job offered a year. Now they must have had 1,000 applicants for each bloody job. So there was no way I was going to get a job or, you know, even a 6-month attachment because I had no experience whatsoever. So that never worked out. So I had to sort of venture into other parts of the Beeb and stuff. But Joe, the lighting guy, wow, did he do some programs? I remember Joe telling me that he would, even in like the mid 70s, he would reckon on going to America at least 3 times a year working, and it wouldn't be for a week, it would be for like 2 months, 2.5 months. So can you imagine the amount of money he earned through working away from base for like 8 weeks at a time? And it would be normally documentaries or a drama, you know, sometimes. I know before, prior to the Beeb, he did The Snow Goose, the feature film, which I think was not Richard Burton, the other guy, the Welsh guy, was in that. He certainly did Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. He was the guy, if you remember, Shirley Bassey, Dame Shirley Bassey was a massive star in the 70s and 60s. She had her own BBC series, and I remember Joe telling me, he said, "Well, you won't believe what we did on Wednesday, Gary." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "We lit up the whole of the front of Television Centre for the opening title sequence for her." And he said the amount of lighting was unbelievable to light up the side of the building where it says BBC Television Centre. And apparently, she drove up in a car and in a limo and got out, and that was the opening title. That was the only shot of the opening titles for the series. He also did, I remember him telling me, and I actually saw proof, he showed me proof of it before he passed away about 4 or 5 years ago now, Joe. He did the Jonathan Miller series, do you remember that? The Body in Question, which was a documentary science features series, but it was filmed, some of it was filmed at Ealing, on the stages there. And I think, Joe, the story went that Joe had done a series or a program with Jonathan Miller prior to that, and he got on really well with him, and to the point of mucking about with him and basically swearing at him. Now, this man is the star of the show, and Joe is just one of the crew, albeit a supervisor, but, you know, he's got to do a lot to do with the director and stuff, cameramen. So he would know everyone on the crew anyway, on the stage. And how can I put... I'm going to have to swear here. I'm not going to use the C word, but that's the word he would use. And he would call Jonathan Miller, to his face, a fucking C. But playfully. And Jonathan Miller completely took it in good stead and gave back as good as he was given. So that was that. So then Joe gets the job for The Body in Question 6 months later. So first day on the set at Ealing to film some bits, whatever. Joe's, you know, they set up the lighting. Jonathan Miller's there going through the script with the director. Da, 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 da. Joe walks up to Jonathan Miller in front of him and says, "Hello, you fucking see." And everyone's sort of gone, "Whoa, you can't say that." And Jonathan Miller's looking at him, "Hello, Joe, you fucking see, how are you?" So they were playing around. And then years later, like 30 years later, there was a book later, a BBC book of the series, which he got. And he got Jonathan Miller to autograph it for him, which he did. But guess what he put in the inscription? That's right. "To Joe, you effing see, from Jonathan Miller." Or "Love, Jonathan Miller." And he still had that up to about 10 years ago. So it was a bit of fun. The one last thing was in, I think it must have been before, just before I left school in 76, Joe took me out on a shoot for a play for today in London, a day, you know, on location. And it's like, whoa, this is really good to see how everything is done. You know, the lighting, how the, you know, how the director works with the cast, how the crew sets up stuff, you know, on the set. And we were in a cafe, I remember, round the corner from New Scotland Yard in London. And we were there early, and we were allowed to park the trucks and stuff, the crew vehicles, in the street where you're not normally allowed to park because it's the middle of London. And it was a play for today, and I can't remember who was in it. But it was just around the corner from New Scotland Yard, I remember that. And it was in what we in the UK call a greasy spoon, which is a sort of working man's cafe. But we'd taken it over. It was shut for the day, but, you know, we'd taken it over for the shoot. So Joe said, "Oh, go and sit down, mate." You know, and I sat down at one of the tables. He said, "I'm busy. I've got to do a few bits." He said, "Just have a, if you have a chat with someone, you know, go on." But being a 15-year-old and quite shy, it's like, that's quite difficult. Excuse me, what does this do? And you're looking at the camera, sort of thing. can't really do that. So I just sat at one of the tables in the Greasy Spoon and just watched, you know, almost open mouth. Like, bloody hell, I'm right here, you know, and I'm going to see this on the telly in 6 months. Anyway, so it started to fill up with cast, and obviously the crew were setting up light, sound, camera, props. And I was at one of these, you know, these little sort of tables that have got four seats, two on each side of the table in the cafe. And I sat in one, and then a few people came and sat on the other side of the table, not taking much notice of me. And then someone came and sat next to me, and they're sort of setting the camera up, and the director's there, and whoever the lead actor was, I can't for the life of me remember who it was now. So suddenly the it goes a little bit quiet, and I'm still sitting there. And the director goes, "Okay, let's go for a rehearsal, shall we?" And I've gone, "Bloody hell, I'm on the set. I've got to get out of here." So I just said, excuse me, I've got to go over there now. Thank you." So I just moved up and sort of nipped off the set quick, went and stood with Joe, and he looked at me, he said, "I wondered how long it would take you to get out of there. If I'd have sat there, I would have been on the television, because it was just in the background, as, you know, they were just extras. But in fact, looking back on it, I should have bloody sat there and had a cup of tea on set and been in the programme, but there you go. And I do remember that we did, for some reason, finish. We broke for lunch early that day, around about 11 o'clock. And of course, as Joe was in charge of the lighting guys, which is only maybe three or four guys, it was Joe's job to divvy out the money for lunch. So he just, you know, bungs them out of the BBC money. He's got a brown envelope. And he says, you know, "Hey, guys," and he gave them each their money. And he turns to me, he said, "There you go, Gary." And it was like £5. And I've gone, "Bloody hell, that's a lot of money." I've gone, "You can't give me that, Joe. That's, you know, that's BBC's money." He said, "Don't be daft. Just take it. We're going around the corner to have something to eat. That's what it's for." So we go around the corner, and where do we go at 11 o'clock in the morning? We go in the pub. And I'm 17 years old, and I'm thinking, "Bloody hell, should I be here?" He said, "Don't be daft. We'll go and get something to eat. Come on." And it was like, you know, pie and chips. And I had like a orange juice and lemonade, and they're having their three or four pints. but, you know, that's what, I mean, that's, it sort of scars you for life, doesn't it? That turns you on to being, wanting to work in television or what, which I managed later on, but not in the way that Joe achieved, unfortunately. But never mind. I had a good time with my experiences and places I've been. So, there we are. So next time, we'll wrap it up here. My goodness, it's 55 minutes or so, 53 minutes. I didn't think I was going to go on this long today. Next time, we'll talk about sort of my later life in freelance land after I left the Beeb, in working in Soho in London, and then working for Formula One and going to races and stuff like that, which is my other interest apart from music, was motorsport. So that's that. So hope you enjoyed this. If you've got any questions, don't forget to subscribe and like, whatever they say. If you've got any questions, feel free to drop me a line at the bottom here, and I'll always answer them. It'll be good to hear from you. So anyway, so that's it for today. Hope you enjoyed this one, and see you soon. All the best.